ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Good afternoon and happy Monday. Selena Green here bringing you another week of The Country Hour. And it certainly has been some of the driest conditions up to this point of the year for many folks across the state, from what I've been hearing, but also seeing myself as you travel around. How prepared are you in terms of your fodder supplies if things carry on like this for more weeks to come? I'm going to talk shortly about some avenues for support, particularly for dairy farmers if you're struggling to source feed. But if you are across any avenues, perhaps for other industry groups, for tracking down somewhere it's in short supply and you want to pass that on, my talkback number today, 1300 222 891 or the text line at 0467 922 891. But first up today, well, half-year profits for the agribusiness giant Elders have fallen more than 70% compared with the same time last year. And in an announcement to the Australian Stock Exchange today, Elders reported an underlying profit after tax of $14.4 million for the first half of this year, citing particularly challenging trading conditions for the first quarter of 2024. But Elders says the outlook is better for the coming months and it expects to reach its original forecast annual profit. I spoke with Elders Managing Director and Chief Executive Mark Allison a short time ago, who told me it was an incredibly challenging start.
I think the first half, without sounding like a football commentator, was the story of two quarters, because the first quarter was very, very difficult. And when we look at the average of the last 10 years of Q1s, the average has been about 37 million EBIT. And for the first quarter this year, even though we didn't break it up, you can see by the pictorial that we've included in the pack that it's close to zero. So it's a very odd occurrence, and what we've seen is the momentum build as the forecasts of dry conditions evaporated and rain came down in eastern Australia, and livestock markets reset, and summer croppers crop in, etc. So we've seen a build in momentum since the first quarter.
What would particularly, as far as the trading conditions for that first quarter, that really led to that result? Was it simply due down to the weather conditions?
Well, I think it was there was a big sentiment component, which I haven't seen. I've been running ag companies for 40 years, or around in the industry for 40 years, and running ag companies for 30 years. And I hadn't seen it where the outlook, the weather forecasts were for El Nino. On the back of that, in combination with interest rate environment, geopolitical environment, some of the other policies that were being put forward through on a geopolitical front or domestic front, I think there was quite a cautious sentiment with the thought that it would be drier than average. A lot of particularly northern producers felt that they needed to destock because they'd have to be paying for feed. There was a hold put on planting inputs, so for pre-fertiliser, fallow spraying with weed control, because the thought was that it would be drier than average, and then that slowed everything to hand to mouth. So I think it's a combination of factors, and that sentiment's still out there to an extent. But of course, what happened in the as we came through after Christmas and in the new year, there was extensive rainfall through a number of the agricultural areas in eastern Australia.
And seeing the flow on of that into things like your resale and wholesale sales, things people purchasing things less, like crop protection, fertiliser down, animal health and seed products were up. So a bit of a mixed bag from the retail front.
Yeah, I think so. Once the value of livestock started to improve, then people are willing to spend more money on veterinary products for them, etc. But it's not dissimilar to what we've seen in metropolitan retail, just that sentiment of not buying discretionary stuff, only buying as late as you need to buy. But, of course, in agriculture, it's not a consumer situation, it's an industrial production situation, where it meant that the systems changed. I mean, getting rid of cattle, then when it was clear that it wasn't actually going to be an El Nino, then needing to buy cattle back in because you had more grass than you could poke a stick at, was it just makes for another degree of difficulty and uncertainty.
As you say, things started to turn around in the second quarter. Now we've got current dry conditions across many parts of the country again, so WA, South Australia, Victoria in particular. How much will a good break and the timing of that for winter crops and for winter plantings influence things going forward?
I think for a big chunk of eastern Australia, the prime planting time is Anzac Day, and there was good rainfall through the through those cereal areas, like 10 days before Anzac Day. So it was an early break as opposed to a normal break. And that kind of covers a number of areas. Obviously, it's still dry in South Oz, particularly the peninsulas, and Victoria as well. In Western Australia, speaking with big growers over there, that they tend to dry seed and knowing the rain will come later. There's over 50% of the crop, I think, has been dry-seeded in the west. And what that means from an elder's viewpoint is that there may be lower imports pre-plant, but then clearly NPK and fertilisers are required to grow a crop, and pest control, there tends to be more weed activity in crop if there hasn't been pre-plant applications made. So from our viewpoint, we see it as kind of average, in some areas above average, but an average season. And across the whole of Australia, the size of the winter crop only fluctuates, regardless of drought or flood or whatever, fluctuates in the area of 10% across the whole of Australia.
What about expectations for livestock prices? So you mentioned, obviously, political factors have an influence on these things as well. We had a recent announcement of the end of live export of sheep by sea, an expectation of perhaps seeing some ripple effects of that on markets and prices across the country this far out as producers reassess their positions?
Yeah, I think we've largely seen that. And this goes to my earlier point of the sentiment early on, because the gap or the difference between sheep prices in WA and South Australia and Eastern Australia was significant, to the point where processors were travelling to Western Australia and could buy sheep there, transport them back to Eastern Australia, and still come and get ahead of the cost game. So I think that uncertainty has largely played out in the sheep trade. I was in beef a couple of weeks ago, and there's also the concern that there may be a knock-on effect on the northern Australian live export market, which would be quite problematic, a massive positive industry, and like the sheep trade in the west, with animal welfare standards, which are world-class. There's no doubt they're world-class. So I think that plays to the sentiment comment I made earlier. But in terms of the macroeconomic drivers, we'd expect it seems that the predictions are for solid livestock prices going forward, and on the cattle front, with the herd running down in North America, and particularly US, there is some supply pressure that may help it to stay higher.
We've heard a bit about rural property sales still being quite strong this past year, so the real estate financial services side of things seems to still be travelling quite okay.
Yeah, and I think with our real estate business, it's again, because it's, on face value, you say real estate, what's happening there, and then most people, particularly our investors, are metropolitan based, and they think about interest rate impacts on house prices, etc. But for us, there's a big part of it, like 25%, the farmland real estate, and that does key off livestock prices, so there is a link there, and that's been okay. Largely, the Chinese money investing in that area has been replaced by family office money and also Canadian super fund money. Another part of our real estate business is the regional rural residential, and again, that's had a similar but not to the same extent pressures that metropolitan house prices have had. And then a growing part, and I think it's up to 30% now, is actually property management. So a book of rental properties, which has grown quite significantly, and that's actually in a very positive environment with rent prices, and our property management business has been quite positive.
So going back to the expectations around profits for this year, and even though after that very poor start, the expectation is for Elders to be on track for the $120, $140 million full-year earnings, as you previously announced?
Yeah, I think so. Our focus is to deliver to the top end of that range. And, you know, the momentum's continued into the second half for the first 6 weeks. So that's positive. And our three-year view, because our APON plans are 3 years, our three-year view is that we can hit the 5 to 10% through the cycles, so we can offset the poor start to the APON plan by the time we get to the end of it and hit that 5 to 10% growth of EBIT and earnings per share at above 15% ROC by the end of 26.
Is that mainly, though, hinging on sentiment and certainty returning to the ag industry rather than does it revolve any sort of major restructure or change of tact about how Elders does business?
No, not at all. So our philosophy for many, well, for all the APON plans, and certainly since I've been around as chair and CEO, is very low pulse rate, methodical stuff. So within that FY26 or end of the APON plan assessment, to be precise, 89% of the drivers of that are in our control. So they're backward integration, they're the benefits of our systems modernisation, they're our supply chain streamlining, they're our wool, big automated wool facilities and the growth of market share there. So 11% in that modelling comes from, you know, livestock price cycles, etc. Things out of our control.
Of course, a couple of years ago we were talking some stunning numbers. Can you see things returning to those record years?
Yeah, I mean, there is a bit like the first quarter this year. There's a whole combination of positive impacts at the same time. But, you know, our philosophy right from the beginning, and it's a farmer's philosophy as well, is that you have your cost and capital at a position, because we're in agriculture, and you have the diversifications of your enterprise in place, so that in bad seasons you make good money, and in good seasons you make great money. And I think the record profit of that year was a great season where we made exceptional money.
That is Mark Allison there, the Managing Director and Chief Executive of Elders. It is 17 minutes past 12. All nominations are now open for South Australia's Ag Town of the Year for 2024. This award's been running since 2019 now, so a few years, and it recognises towns excelling in agricultural practices, and it's all about supporting vibrant and resilient communities. So we had last year's winner, Woodna, on the Eyre Peninsula. Previous winners have included Maipalonga, Kimber, Pinneroo, Cleve as well. As I said, nominations for the next Ag Town of the Year, they're open. They close on Wednesday the 5th of June, and you can make them at agtown.com.au. After that, you'll be invited to vote for which of the nominated towns you believe deserves to win, and that will happen throughout the later part of June, and the top 10 towns will be announced in early July. October is when the 2024 winner will be announced.
You're listening to Selena Green on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Well, your paddocks might be looking very different right now than they normally would at this time of the year, and unfortunately not for the best. You know, there's a lot of dry seeding going on, a lot of producers churning through feed as many of you wait patiently on breaking rains. The South Australian Dairy Farmers Association is urging farmers to plan well ahead and reach out for support if your fodder supplies are starting to dwindle. Robert Brokenshire is SADA's president. Good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Selena. Thank you.
We've been hearing so much about just how dry it is across many parts of the state. A lot of people still waiting for those breaking rains. What are you hearing from dairy farmers across the regions?
Well, all the dairy farmers I'm talking to, Selena, are definitely very keen for a break in the next few days to the end of May. It's getting late, it's getting cold, there's no dry feed left, and even the irrigation's slowing down. So it's certainly a challenging time for dairy farmers right at the moment.
For many of those regions, and I guess particularly as you get further south, by this time of the year it would usually be pretty green. They wouldn't need to be doing a lot of extra feeding at this time?
No, well, that's right. We'd be backing off on our feeding now, and, you know, we're our family farm at Mount Compass. I can't recall last time I didn't see the dryland paddocks with some feed growing and a nice green colour to it by now. So, yeah, we'd be looking to back off, and we'd the cow's diet would be changing for the better, and we'd be starting to say, well, maybe we can cut back on some silage. But at the moment, it's actually the opposite, and everybody's accelerating their silage and hay feed out, which is obviously hitting their storage supply.
I'm also hearing that extra supply of hay is pretty hard to come by as well. So are you hearing of people running out and then and having a struggle of sourcing more?
So far, most of the dairy farmers that we've been working with is their association, SADA. We've been able to help them find hay, or they've found their own hay. The problem at the moment is, one, the price seems to be going up every week, and two, because we don't know exactly how much fodder we're going to need to get through a period that, quite honestly, may be August before we start to get decent feed now, because it's also getting cold even if it rains. And so we're actually saying to our dairy farmers, take a stock, look at what you need, estimate what you may have to purchase, and if you can't get it from your local suppliers, contact SADA's office and we'll be happy to try and help facilitate a purchase. But bear in mind that the longer you leave it without acquiring, the harder it'll get and the dearer it'll probably get.
Yeah, so planning ahead and having sort of that bit extra rather than leaving it to the last minute and suddenly having to scramble to source it, and hopefully you can.
Well, that's right. Certainly at the moment, you know, people are still able to generally buy good quality dairy hay, but the price is expensive. And I know that some of the bigger dairy farmers have actually purchased a lot in the last few weeks, so that'll start to eat into what stocks are available from the fodder growers. It's a time to really have a close look at what you need, work on a scenario that says we may not have feed until August, and then try and assess what you might need to buy. But don't leave it until the last minute, because it may be very, very hard to source then, depending on when we do get the opening.
Yeah, and depending on when that is, I mean, if it is, you know, still the case of needing to do this feeding for a few months more, what impact does that then have on, you know, the following year? Rob, does that have flow on for next year?
Well, it could. One, because most of us try to produce enough fodder or purchase enough fodder so that you've got some carryover and some, you know, opportunity for a good start. Secondly, of course, we have to remember that last spring was an awful spring, and a lot of dairy farmers reported to me that, you know, their cuts were down by anything up to 50%. So obviously there isn't the carryover that there was in previous years. And, of course, what we're going to need is a really good late spring so that we can catch up on the late autumn start, or virtually, in all honesty, no start in autumn.
Well, hopefully that is the case, that it is sooner rather than later. But as you say, planning ahead and reaching out for support for those farmers who do find that they need that extra bit of help sourcing that extra feed.
Yep, that's what the plan needs to be for each individual farmer. And look, they don't have to carry the burden completely by themselves. You know, certainly SADA will do what we can to use our networks and contacts to facilitate hay for them. And of course, I would expect that, you know, other organisations that advocate for farmers would do the same for whatever their sheep or beef cattle are.
Rob Brokenshire, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Selena. Appreciate it.
Robert Brokenshire, who is the president of the South Australian Dairy Farmers Association. It is 23 and a half minutes past 12.
Jimmy Steins here, and if you're looking for life advice, let me suggest the ABC Listen app.
Try Ladies, We Need to Talk.
What if it's a choice between I'm staying or I'm living out of my car with my kids?
You might also like Parental as Anything, Teens.
We all need to face the fact that teens are sending and receiving nude pics.
Or Life Matters.
Let's begin at your 60th birthday party.
Load up a podcast and level up your life with the ABC Listen app.
Just before we head to the Weather Bureau, just letting you know, if you're a primary producer who was impacted by the River Murray floods in 2022, you are encouraged, if you haven't already done so, to apply for PERS's two recovery grant schemes, the Irrigation Infrastructure Grant and the Primary Producer Recovery Grant. Just letting you know that applications for those close on Sunday the 30th of June. So neither scheme will accept new applications after that date. However, approved applicants from the recovery grant scheme will still be able to make make Tier 2 claims within their existing six-month time frame or approved extension period. If you want help to make an application, the recovery hotline number is 1800 931 314. Off to the Weather Bureau, Chris Kent is our forecaster today. Hello, Chris.
Hi, Selena. How are you?
Very good. What's the story as we start another week?
Yeah, as we start another week, we've had a little bit of rain around. Agricultural areas have picked up around 3 to 6 millimetres over the last 24 hours to 9 a.m. this morning. Most of that's been about the Mount Lofty ranges, but we have sort of seen a little bit down on the southeast KI and over on the Eyre Peninsula. For the next 12 hours, we might sort of see a few more showers about the agricultural areas with 2 to 5 millimetres potentially falling. But those showers should start easing up tonight. And for the rest of the week, really, looking reasonably dry again. So those four-day totals but from now until midnight on Friday, really only 2 to 5 falling in the next 12 hours, like I said. So it is looking like another dry week ahead, unfortunately. And as well, with that below average minimums, we're going to be expecting as well a high pressure system moving across the Bight. It's going to be bringing some cooler southerlies and clearer skies as well. So temperatures getting down towards freezing, especially away from the coast across the southern parts of the state for the next week. And Wednesday at this stage looks to be the coolest morning before winds start turning a bit more around to the northeasterly, and we do see a bit of warmth starting to creep in later in the week. Very slow weather moving, very slow weather pattern at the moment. Unfortunately that dry weather is just continuing for this week.
And as you say, over that 4-day period, when really not much to speak of in terms of accumulative totals?
No. So, 2 to 5 millimetres. And if you don't get too much this afternoon, then, for the rest of the week, not expecting very much at all. So, should remain pretty dry for this week. Those very small totals are, unfortunately, all that we've got at the moment.
All right. Thanks for that, Chris.
No worries, thank you.
Chris Kent there from the Weather Bureau. So let's have a look at the western inland parts of New South Wales for tomorrow. And the story there for both the upper and lower western district are for partly cloudy conditions. The upper western district, there is a chance of fog in the southeast in the early morning with light winds becoming south to southeasterlies, 15 to 25 k's an hour in the morning. Overnight temperatures falling to between 5 and 8 degrees with daytime temperatures reaching between 17 and 21 degrees. Now for the lower western district, as I said, also partly cloudy conditions, patches of frost and the chance of fog in the far east in the morning, light winds becoming southerlies, 15 to 25 k's an hour in the morning and then becoming light in the evening. It's going to be very cold overnight, overnight temperatures falling to between 2 and 7 degrees with daytime temperatures reaching up around 18 degrees.
Oh, mornings!
Will Anderson, you've been targeted.
It's too early for advertising. Skip.
The adverts are in your home.
Spam on my fridge now? No. Unsubscribe.
You're being influenced.
I don't want any of this. Are you listening to me?
When the whole world's gone ad.
Oh, we're listening.
Thank goodness there's Gruen. Wednesday nights on ABC TV. And always free, always entertaining on ABC iView.
And don't forget, if you want to keep across all the latest and greatest rural news throughout the day, apart from listening to The Country Hour, you can find plenty of great stuff on the ABC Rural website, abc.net.au/news/rural, or just put ABC Rural into search engines, probably a quicker way to do it. There's a lot of fantastic stories on there at the moment, including the future of livestock mustering and how drones will be replacing horses, motorbikes and helicopters. So hop on and have a look at that. Coming up in this next half an hour, another rock lobster season comes to a close. We'll find out how fishers fared in terms of catches and prices. But also look at, teaching your children about how to make an extra buck and learn the value of money. And you'll meet some young people from regional South Australia who are quite young entrepreneurs.
listening to The Country Hour. For more stories from across the country, go to abc.net.au/rural. On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill, this is Selena Green. Selena Green.
Well, hi there. Today, we celebrate something pretty special. It is World Bee Day. Did you know there's more than 2,500 species of native bees here in Australia? They help us grow our food, they keep our ecosystems healthy, but many of those species actually live underground. And you'll learn a bit more about them shortly. Also coming up, how did you go about teaching your children about finance and the value of money? You're going to meet some young entrepreneurs from regional South Australia. I've come up with some ways to make themselves some cash to fund their dreams.
I'm making lemonade so I could get my boat, a blue one, so I could catch some fish in Waiala.
What kind of fish do you want to get?
Tuna, salmon and mackerels and some marlins.
His maths has certainly gotten a bit better and I've been actively pushing for that, trying to make sure that he's the guy that deals with the money box and trying to get him to actively work out how that change comes about.
Now, it might be a lot of cups of lemonade for a boat, but you've got to start somewhere. That story's coming up, but I'd love to hear from you today as well. Maybe you've worked with your children to help them understand how to manage their money, or maybe make some of their own. If they've come to you saying, "Mum, Dad, I want to buy this," and you're thinking, well, you can start saving up for that, buddy. Lemonade stalls, those sorts of things. Well, let me know. My talkback number is 1300 222 891, or the text line is 0467 922 891. I'll come back to that story after headlines with Matt Coleman. Hello, Matt.
Hello, Selena. In the news this afternoon, South Australia's energy minister says the damaged furnace at the Whyalla Steelworks has been repaired. The blast furnace has not poured metal for more than 2 months, with the owner's GFG Alliance struggling to restart the plant after planned maintenance. The company revealed nearly a fortnight ago that the shell of the furnace had been damaged during efforts to get the furnace going once again. The state government has announced a new timeline for the reconfiguration of the notorious intersection at Portrush and Glen Osmond Roads. The federal government is investing a further $100 million into upgrading the southeastern freeway through its 2024-25 budget. The funding will help with the redesign of the intersection, which will help reduce incidents at the bottom of the freeway. And there are calls for more people to donate blood amid a national shortage. The Red Cross says South Australia needs another 200 donations every day to meet demand. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thank you, Matt. Matt Coleman there with your headlines. Well, rock lobster remains one of the last sectors in Australia still battling those huge tariffs that have closed off exports into China. So as another lobster season comes to a close in the southern zone of South Australia for another year, how have our fishers fared? Prices remain steady compared to last year, but still nowhere near pre-China ban highs. Southeastern Professional Fishermen's Association Executive Officer Nathan Kimber says most fishers in the region filled their quota pretty early this year.
Season formally closes on the 31st of May, and yeah, the vast majority of boats have certainly been finished and some finished now for quite a while. There might still be one or two along the coast that are still going to fill their quotas for this current season. But pretty much coming to the end of another long sort of drawn out season.
So those few that are still going, are those fishers that maybe held off a bit in the hopes that China might have come back this season, but of course it unfortunately didn't?
Oh, not necessarily. You know, there's 145 boats in the fishery, and each small business runs their own operation. Yeah, they obviously work really closely with their processor and exporter, and it's just more about, spreading the fish out into to months of the fishery where other fishers might be finished, in the hope of potentially receiving stronger prices. Yeah, my understanding is, that the price late in the season, was pretty reflective of the price sort of right throughout the season. So, we didn't see that uptick in demand later in the season, which sometimes we do see.
And how did fishers find the season overall, Nathan? Was it quite easy to fill their quota? Was there enough stock?
Yeah, look, the stocks, for the past sort of 5 to 6 years have been continuing a really positive trend, which is great. You know, that's sort of certainly helped us navigate the various sort of trade issues that we've had to deal with over the past 3 to 4 seasons. Catch rates have been really quite strong. We've had this, strangely early and long upwelling event in the southeast of South Australia, which, sort of started early November and is still continuing. So we've had colder water than normal, which has had potentially had a slight negative impact on catch rate, but nothing too significant.
So earlier in the season, Nathan, we did have that news of abalone viral ganglioneuritis being found in the southern zone fishery. Were fishers in Port Macdonnell and Southend largely able to recover from the disruptions that caused?
Yeah, they have. Look, it was. Yeah, we understand that the Persian Biosecurity SA had a job to do when they first found AVG in South Australia, and there were some temporary closures put in place. They've all now lifted. The rock lobster sector has signed on to PERS's code of conduct around AVG management, which lists sort of a range of measures that we need to put into place on a day-to-day basis, which will essentially allow us to continue to fish, as we sort of normally would, which is good. But it was certainly a bit of a scary sort of couple of months there. And like I've said before, I think to you on this program, obviously, first and foremost, our thoughts are with the abalone sector around this virus. We certainly need to navigate our fisheries way through it as well.
And for a number of years now, Nathan, we have been speculating on when exports of lobster will be able to return to China. Do you think we'll have news on that before the next season starts in September?
Oh, I certainly hope for Elsie, but I've probably been hopeful now for about 3 years. So, we're really buoyed by what's happened in the wine sector, and other sectors over the last 2 to 3 years. There seems to be a positive momentum with regards to trade with China. We're buoyed by the comments that the Federal Trade Minister has made around the Chinese Premier's visit to Australia in sort of mid to late June as being a potential time when things might change for live rock lobster exports direct to China. But when it happens, we'll all be very relieved. But it's sort of been that long now that I'm not pinning my hopes on anything or any date in particular.
That is Nathan Kimber. He's the Executive Officer of the Southeastern Professional Fishermen's Association. He was speaking to Elsie Adamo. Well, today is World Bee Day. It's the 24 hours that enthusiasts dedicate to celebrating some of Australia's smallest workers in the agricultural workforce who help us produce everything from honey, of course, to almonds, carrots, onions, you name it. The charity called the Wean Bee Foundation raises funds for research to address the national and global threats to bees, and it lobbies on behalf of the pollinators to all levels of government, the apiculture industry, food industries and universities. Well, the CEO, Fiona Chambers, says World Bee Day is an opportunity to raise awareness of how important bees are to our food security, biodiversity and ecosystems.
You've got crops like almonds that are 100% reliant on honeybees. You've got other crops like apples, avocados. You've got vegetable seeds, so carrots, onion seed, melons. So it's over 53 different crops that we as humans eat and rely on for our healthy diets.
You've outlined there some of the reasons why pollination and bees are so important to Australia and Australian agriculture, but is there a plan in place to make sure that this is viable for the future?
Australia, unfortunately, is one of the very few countries in the world that has no national plan to protect and preserve our pollinators. So it's one of the major project areas that Wean Bee Foundation is working on at the moment, to work with industry, government, the environment sector, to develop one national pollination strategy so we can really put the focus on those areas that will make a difference to our pollinators.
And what kinds of strategies would you want to see in place?
It's going to be around things like pollinator habitat conservation for our wild pollinators. It's around better and stronger biosecurity controls. But it's even things as basic as data management. So we actually don't even know what, in 5 years' time, how many hives are we going to need to meet the demand for all of those crops. So we just need some really good data so that we can make sure we've got enough bees to pollinate our crops.
There have been some challenges in recent years for bees in Australia, not to mention bushfires that wiped out large habitats of bees over the last, say, 5 or so years, and also varroa mite on the east coast, especially in New South Wales. So how are Australia's bee populations going at the moment?
The first thing to understand is you've got honeybees, and honeybees are managed by beekeepers, and they have a different range of problems to our wild native bees, of which there's over 2,000 different species. So all of those bees are important. It's not one or the other. We need all of those bees to pollinate not just our food crops, but also all of our native plants. And things like habitat loss from bushfires are really, really major threats to all of our pollinators, as are things like pests and disease and varroa mite. The recent, 2 years ago, varroa mite came to Australia, and that's a major threat for our honeybees.
What are some of the biosecurity measures that are in place in Australia for bee protection?
At each of the ports, at most of or many of the ports in Australia, there are sentinel hives. And that was how they found the incursion 2 years ago, that there were varroa mite in that. So there are biosecurity things that happen at the port level, and then even state to state. So border controls, and we saw the closing of borders, which has had a huge impact for the availability for our farmers being able to access pollinators when they need them.
There are, as you mentioned, the honeybees and the native bees. How many bees, on estimate, is there in Australia right now?
In terms of honeybees, we have around about 600,000 hives. And with native bees, there's probably about 2,500 species, different species of native bee in Australia.
And do you think many people actually know that there are so many species of native bees? Because quite often when you do think of the bees, you do think of those honeybees.
Yeah, look, most people are really surprised that we have just so many different species of bee in Australia. The other thing people are really surprised to learn is that only 11 native bee species live in hives. So most of our native bee species are solitary, and 30% of those are cavity nesting. So they live in twigs and stems, or like native bee hotels. But the vast majority, 2/3 of our native bee species, actually breed and reproduce underground.
That is the CEO of the not-for-profit Wean Bee Foundation, Fiona Chambers, speaking with Jane McNaughton.
This is ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
With Selena Green on this Monday here on the Country Hour. Well, the South Australian Landcare Awards have been given out, and some fantastic South Australian projects have been recognised, focusing on drought resilience, regeneration and climate innovation. Amongst the winners was Buckleboo Station, which took out the Australian Government Sustainable Agriculture Landcare Award. Well, Buckleboo Station is a 250,000 acre station located 54 kilometres northwest of Kimber, and it runs self-replacing dorpers. A few years ago, the station undertook a new property management plan, incorporating ecological plans into landscape management, ensuring regeneration and drought resilience. Station manager James Kerr says the changes have made a huge impact, and he told Kate Higgins that it was a proud moment to be recognised for the planning and work it takes to improve the landscape.
It was wonderful to be at the awards ceremony. I have to confess, 2 years ago I spoke at the National Landcare Conference in Sydney. And I went to the gala conference dinner and the awards night for the national award. It feels a little surreal that we're now actually representing South Australia in the national award that'll be held later in the year. And it's just, a proud moment, because I do recall sitting in the in the audience that night watching people from all over Australia receiving their awards. And you have to remember that the dedication of the planning that goes into changing our landscape, all the teams that are involved. To us, our team is not necessarily a team of volunteers, but we've certainly have a team that are helping us and guiding and working with us to make these changes to our landscape. And it just was really lovely to be there at the awards in Port Augusta and see the enthusiasm from all those different teams, from young people right through to the Aboriginal works that are being done, and also farming groups right across Australia. And I think, we're just looking forward to the national awards now.
Tell us a little bit about
how you got nominated and why you won.
Well, we've been fairly proactive, I feel, in since we've started making big changes to the station. We've been working very hard to share our story and what we're doing. I feel that it's important when you make changes to your farming enterprise or grazing enterprise. And the work that we're doing, I feel, is a story worth sharing in the sense that we've completely changed our grazing management and the process of the way we go about our operation. And we're starting to see extraordinary results on the country. And I think that's the important thing is that, you know, we all accept that sometimes we make management decisions and it doesn't always work out. But in our case, the ecologists, the feedback that we're getting from ecologists has been very, very strong. And so that's why we're continuing to help other people try and understand that by making these changes, you can build drought resilience. And I think that is our main objective, is building drought resilience for the long haul.
In building drought resilience, grazing management seems to be key. Can you talk us through or just recap a little bit what those changes to grazing practices were?
Absolutely, I'd love to do that. What we've done is looked at the history of this station, and when you look over a lot of pastoral areas, most of the areas are used a method called set stocking. And technically what set stocking means is that you just put the sheep in the paddock, you work out your total area of the property, and you put so many sheep in each paddock. What we discovered is that the paddocks that were overstocked and overgrazed, the long-term effect of what has happened is that the very palatable native grasses, kangaroo grass, wallaby grass, and even some of the more palatable spear grasses have virtually disappeared from the landscape. So in order to help the landscape recover after many, many years of set stocking, we decided to split the whole property into six 40,000-acre paddocks. And I've put all the sheep in one mob. And what we do is graze an area for 3 months. And then by the time we move right around the station, each area has about 15 months complete rest. And on top of that, we have removed all the goats from the station and we're keeping the kangaroo numbers low. So that's the big change we've made, is that the method that I'm using now is not rotational grazing, it's long rest grazing. And because of that, I've seen enormous changes in the landscape.
And you mentioned that ecologists are also giving you pretty positive reports on that change in the landscape. What are some of the things that they're noticing?
Well, it's just the regeneration right across the station. We're not just doing one little area. We've chosen to do this regeneration work across the whole station. We've been working with Australian Integrated Carbon. They're one of Australia's largest carbon farming companies, and we have a large carbon project approved for Buckleboo Station in order to detail the landscape as they see it. And then every year when they come back to do an audit, they go right back to those coordinates and they use measuring sticks on the ground. So they look at the height of the plant and then they use very sophisticated drone technology to look at the plants from the air. So they can see how much the plants have grown on the ground, and then they can run the drones over the top and can see how much the landscape's changing. So they're giving us very, very strong feedback as to the change that they're seeing. This type of technology is wonderful from the ecologist.
Did you do much soil testing and sort of see sort of the quality of your soils before or after, in addition to the plant measuring and the drone surveys?
Absolutely. We've actually introduced soil probes as well across the property, so understanding what's happening below the ground down to a metre below the ground. And it is absolutely fascinating looking at how much moisture is available down to a metre. And what the soil probes can also do is analyse how much moisture plants take from the soil and at what time of the day they're taking that moisture. So a lot of our country is blue bush and salt bush, and that being a deep-rooted plant, it's really, really interesting to see the effect of how long the moisture stays in the ground on certain soil types, how much those plants are actually taking from the soil. Because of all the regeneration that's been happening with our blue bush and salt bush, I am really keen to get a soil scientist or a PhD student to analyse the soil carbon under the blue bush and salt bush. I think, and I'm quite confident in saying this, that we've seen amazing regeneration across all the bush country, and I'm very sure that we'll be seeing a big build-up of soil carbon under all that blue bush and salt bush. And to me, that is a game changer for South Australia. So all of this work we're doing is helping us to ensure that we're building drought resilience before the next major drought. My vision is to have the property to its optimum before the drought.
That was James Kerr, the manager of Bucklebu Station. Well, in another category, producers Adrian and Kate McCabe of McCabe Agco took out the Australian Government Climate Innovation Award. They run a grain property at Hamley Bridge, that's around 90 kilometres north of Adelaide. And Mr McCabe says he wants to make sure that South Australian grains are at the front of the changes needed in the industry.
So I think it's about our ability to adapt to climate change and recognising climate change as a factor in agriculture. So we've always been adapting over time, and I guess 95% of South Australian grain growers, the tillage has been a thing of the past and direct drilling has been a new thing, and it's all been about the interface between obviously climate and food production, which is the soils and protection of soils and maintaining water. So that's an ongoing change in our business, and we're always looking to adapt and change and increase production sustainably and keep our emissions down and have an eye on that to the future. So, no, we continually adapt.
In terms of climate action, what plans do you have going forward for the property?
We're looking at things continuously. We've got plans in place for revegetation concepts and plan development. We're measuring soil carbons to 30 centimetre measurements. We're looking at natural capital accounting implementation and accreditation. Market opportunities for sustainable grain, and we're trying to participate also in a nature repair market as that develops. Obviously, new governments come in, new ideas keep springing upon us, and being able to be in a position where we're able to give some of these things a real trial and a real look and hopefully get some implementations in the future. So actually getting some real change, not some concept change, actually bringing value into it rather than seeing it as pilot projects or ill-informed projects. So I think that's a real passion of both Kate and myself as we move forward. So one, through our involvement in policy more generally and also being able to practically give it a go here on farm is informing us as into the future to hopefully inform policy and ourselves as we go forward. And maybe there's a market for sustainable grain in the future or low emissions grain, hopefully. We're starting to see those markets develop a little bit. There's already the ISCC canola market into Europe. So we just see it as a growing thing that has to change. Governments and major international companies already have their ESG requirements. So this is a thing moving much faster than policy. It's being demanded. We want to be ready for that. And as a policy group, we also want to make sure that South Australian grains are at the front of it.
A South Australian grain producer and Landcare Award winner, Adrian McCabe, speaking there to Kate Higgins. And thank you very much to Farmer Annie, who hopped on the text line to say thank you for that wonderful interview regarding long rest grazing. Learnt a lot. Thank you, Annie, for the feedback. It's 8 minutes to one. Well, in the middle of a cost of living crisis, it's never been more important for the next generation to learn about the value of a dollar. How do you teach your kids about finance? Well, reporter Nikki Natafalas spoke with some budding entrepreneurs from across regional South Australia about how they earn and save.
Charlie, can we please have two bottles of lemonade?
In the world-renowned wine region of South Australia's Barossa Valley, six-year-old Charlie Varsine is selling a different kind of drink. Every few weeks, he sells his homemade lemonade at a stand at the end of his street.
I'm making lemonade so I could get my boy a blue one so I could catch some fish in Waiala.
What kind of fish do you want to get?
Tuna, salmon and mackerels and some marlins.
The idea was sparked when he asked his parents, Luke and Sam, for a fishing boat, and they explained to him that they wouldn't be able to fund it. Shortly after, Charlie was watching the popular kids' TV show Bluey, with the episode showing main character Bluey the dog selling lemonade. Charlie was then inspired to sell some too. Charlie makes the lemonade with his dad, and both his parents help run the stand. His dad, Luke, says the venture has taught Charlie different numeracy skills and other facets of running a business.
There you go. He's going to need seven change, Charlie. Five and a two.
Five.
His maths has certainly gotten a bit better, and I've been actively pushing for that, trying to make sure that he's the guy that deals with the money box and trying to get him to actively work out how that change comes about. The first lemonade stall, I had most of the ingredients and stuff that he needed here. And as for his second lemonade stall, I made him take money out of his first lemonade stall to go and buy the ice. It was a 35 degree day and people don't want a hot bottle of lemonade. If you want to make money, you have to spend it as well sometimes.
Luke says the community's response to Charlie's venture has been overwhelming and humbling.
We're still putting food on the table, but it certainly has affected us in the last few years in terms of how the price of living and that sort of stuff has gone up. And to see everyone reach into their pockets and kindly donate and come to support Charlie has been a really great experience. I think most people these days are pretty keen to see someone little or anyone having a go at it.
In the southeast of the state, 12-year-old Olive Cotton from Mount Gambier has also found a way to make some cash.
That one, thank you.
She sells her own handcrafted watercolour cards, resin key rings, jewellery, and even a picture book that she illustrated herself called The Cat Surprise. Olive says the sales have been helping her reach her saving goals.
Some of it I save, some of it I spend, and some of it I give. I spend it on supplies for my cards and key rings. I usually put more in my savings so that I can save for something like a car when I'm older. I'm also saving to go to Catherine to see my cousin.
In Barmera, roughly 230 kilometres northeast of Adelaide, 11-year-old Till Inglis is putting the poo from her horse Leo to good use.
Horses do have a lot to get out of their system. I decided to start bagging some poo to get some money to go to a horse expo, which is called Equitana. I've made almost $3,000 with horse poo, but I also do run a little business called Leo's Lane, which is the name of my horse, when I sell cards that I make with my Cricket Explore.
Till says other kids should try their hand at making their own money.
I think it's really important that children start to learn the value of money and how it will help them throughout the years instead of relying on other people. I think they should just try whatever they love and just see if they can move their money forward and try their best.
Till's mother, Kirby, says the experience has made Till more mature with her spending.
If she would like to buy something when we're out, we say, of course you can. Well, it's your money. And it definitely makes her stop and think twice about whether it is something that she wants or it's really worth the effort that she had to put in to raise the money.
Miss Inglis says it's also taught Till maths she can apply to her life.
When you go through schooling, most of the time now your maths is about algebra and things that you perhaps are never going to use again. For Till now, she's definitely got an understanding that the money is sitting in a bank and that bank is actually paying her compounding interest.
University of South Australia Chair of Economics, Dr. Susan Stone, says it's important children learn about money from an early age.
This is a skill they're going to need for their entire lives. It doesn't matter if you're struggling to make ends meet or if you are making good money. You still need to budget. You still need to be aware of where your money's going and being responsible. And it's been shown that the earlier kids are introduced to these concepts, actually the better off they do, the more comfortable they are budgeting when they go to uni, when they're on their own.
Dr. Stone says some strategies parents could use to teach their children about money are opening up a bank account for them, giving them an allowance, or taking them grocery shopping to show them how much things cost.
When you take them to the clothing store to buy them, you know, whatever new clothes they need, they really do understand that, you know, you can buy a cheap pair of runners or you can buy the top brand and it's not the same thing, and we need to have priorities and we do need to budget.
Have you get really full time?
Yeah, fill it right up.
While Charlie may not be close to his boat dreams just yet, his dad Luke says he's on the way.
We're looking at a second-hand boat. I haven't even looked at a new boat because that's well out of our price range. Now Charlie goes and jumps on Marketplace and looks at boats, and his common question is, how many lemonade stalls do I need to do to get this boat? And I think that's his benchmark for success now.
I hope he gets to his boat. That is Luke Varsine from Tanunda talking about his son Charlie's lemonade stand. Finishing that report from Vicky Nutterfallis with additional reporting from Eugene Boisvert and Eliza Burlage. 2 minutes to one and time to say hello to Nikolai Balhartz. Hello, happy Monday.
And to you. This afternoon we're going to take a look at some comments that were made by the local boss of Mondelez, which is one of the biggest food companies in the world. So they own Cadbury's and a whole range of some really big recognisable food brands. He was commenting recently well, kind of airing concerns, I suppose, that the future of food manufacturing in Australia could go the same way as car manufacturing, which obviously did not have a very, very kind of very ongoing nature, if I can put it that way. So we're going to take a look at that this afternoon about is there a bit of concern around the future of food manufacturing in the country? And it's also clinical trial day today. You know, sometimes you see those ads online or even in the paper of, you know, would you like to take part in a study that can help advance scientific knowledge, and sometimes you get paid for it as well. We're going to take a look at that. Obviously, there are risks associated as well, but you know, you could arguably contribute a bit to helping others out. So we'll find out a bit more about how that works and how you can take part in it if you want to this afternoon too.
Oh, that would be a very interesting discussion. A lot coming up on Nikolai's program this afternoon. Stick around for that. I'll be back tomorrow at noon for more Country Hour.
The ABC Listen app makes listening to your local ABC radio stations wherever you are as easy as, well, ABC. Tap our logo to stream us live and free.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.